Hello, and welcome back to FreightWaves 3PL Summit. I'm JP Hampstead, strategic analyst here at FreightWaves, and I'm here with Chris Wofford, managing partner of Wofford Advisors, and a specialist in mergers and acquisitions, especially in the 3PL world. Chris, welcome.
Thank you, JP. Great to be here.
Well, we're excited to have you. Why don't we just jump right into it? And with that, can we get a sense of where seller and buyer sentiment is in the market right now? How do owners of 3PLs feel about the value of their companies right now? And how do potential buyers of 3PLs, how are they assessing these businesses right now?
Sure, JP. Thanks for the question. Look, I think that we've come through an incredible wave with COVID, obviously really dire circumstances turning into really boom times. And from my perspective, having done this for 30 years as an investment banker at a bunch of large firms and now out of my own, this is one of the hottest markets that we've seen for selling 3PLs in recent memory. Now, with that said, we obviously have some headwinds that we're experiencing as we are here at the beginning of 2022 that we all are aware of. And inflation, obviously what's going on with Russia and Ukraine and just sort of geopolitics broadly. And those issues absolutely manifest in business models, right? The certainty of cash flows, the certainty of entrance and exit, certainty of closing when deals can be subject to CFIUS review and things of that nature. But I think the real issue that buyers and sellers are struggling through the most right now is how much of a COVID bump did business models experience and how much of those supply demand shifts or changes in behavior are here to stay.
Are people using like 2-year kind of like stacked comparables to try to even out some of that noise? What are some of the strategies that people are looking at to get to numbers that make sense for both parties?
Sure. Well, look, that's a tricky question because there is some segmentation between B2B and B2C, right? So in the B2C world, we've seen an absolute shift in macro factors and they start at the micro level. People being cooped up in their homes has led to, a decade of e-com adoption, literally in 6 to 12 months time period. And it's really quite sticky now because we're almost 2 years into it, behavior wise. So I think that is a bit of a paradigm shift, an acceleration really of the trends that were anticipated on the e-com side of things. So that's its own, I think, particular set of circumstances, because looking back and taking a 3-year average on performance becomes quite complicated if you're, averaging in years when there was not the same COVID adoption. Now, naysayers would say, some of these trends are going to taper off. And I think I mentioned to you in the pre-interview that the journal was talking about how people's consumption patterns have shifted, right, from products to services. I think even with that relatively subtle shift in consumer behavior, you still have a long-standing trend of e-com adoption, and I think that's going to be something that we're going to be experiencing as we go forward. So I think that's a set of valuation parameters that's a bit different. On the B2B side, obviously there's a huge rush into B2C because it's a growing market. The B2B market's much larger than B2C, but even with that said, the question becomes how much of a COVID bump was there to these business models. Truckload brokerage is probably one of the hardest markets right now to get your hands around because there are these fundamental questions going on, including autonomous vehicles and their onset. So I think we're in a really difficult time period for valuing companies, and that obviously leads to increased discrepancies between buyer and seller expectations. But for sure, in 2021, we saw an incredibly robust market environment.
When you talk about gaps between buyers and sellers or a bid-ask spread, I mean, is there a way in which strategic acquirers maybe that are seeing some kind of commercial synergy or some other kind of tech synergy, is there a way that they can kind of build in like a margin of safety or get a little bit more comfortable with these valuations? Do they have an advantage here?
So look, I think you've got two very different sets of circumstances. For a strategic buyer, you're looking at a an acquirer who's trying to think 5, 10, 15, maybe even 20 years down the pike about what the composition of services and markets, capabilities, technology need to be in order for the long-term competitiveness and viability of the business model. So that's a set of values that, you know, I would articulate starts bordering on intrinsic value, right? We're going to go buy something that's going to adjust the trajectory of our business model. The financial buyer is really gated in by a number of different circumstances, right? The entry price, the exit, how long the duration of their hold period, how long their LPs are expecting them to hold the asset for. Now, we've seen a cycle where sponsors were exiting in 2.5-3 years because the growth curve has been really that dramatic. But in this environment, strategics, I believe, have a bit of an advantage over sponsors, where I would have argued last year it was a bit of the inverse. The reason for that is that this intrinsic value concept can enable a strategic to pay a multiple that might otherwise look daunting. Whereas if a sponsor is mistiming their entry into the marketplace at a time when they're buying peak EBITDA and there's a subsequent trough, they're going to get hurt in that investment.
Yeah, that definitely makes a lot of sense. The time horizon and the timing in general of the financial sponsors are, you know, so much different than, for example, and I'll just throw this example out there, like ArcBest buying Molo. We know, you know, anyone who's looked at ArcBest understands why they really want to diversify their revenue into asset light, right? Because of their, you know, like whatever you want to call it, their asset exposure, their Teamsters exposure. Like it's a clearly like a strategic thing that they've been thinking about for many years. You know, you can look at the previous acquisition of Bear Transportation or something like that. So like, to me, like that's a good example of that sort of longer term intrinsic value approach.
Absolutely. Look, I think that there are a number of players who are trying to move out of the box that they're in. Maersk, for example, who's been a prolific acquirer in this cycle, really suffered through a terribly difficult period, right? The container shipping companies were all sort of teetering on the brink. There was massive oversupply, rates fell, freight in certain periods was at, you know, near-term lows. And so if you're sitting there and you've got a bunch of, you know, I've called them floating hotels in the past, where the rate environment goes down, you're really suffering. Now, that's completely reversed in the current environment. But if you're sitting there at Maersk and you're saying, well, how do I make sure that it's not that the supply-demand imbalance doesn't hurt me again, but also how do I make sure that I don't get disintermediated by all the other 3PLs that are out there who are reselling my services? That's led to a strategy that absolutely is focused on lengthening and broadening the range of services. And in fact, even deepening, because Maersk is trying to climb into the enterprise value solution set in the IP stack. So, you know, that's all about owning the customer and making sure that your one segment of the supply chain doesn't get commoditized and then repriced by others.
Yeah, that's really interesting. It makes a ton of sense, especially for the Container Ship Alliance, who have historically not been focused on customer service, because they didn't have to be. But now, they both have a lot of extra cash to deploy. But they also have like big questions about like, you know, what is the most valuable work I can be doing for my customer?
Sure. I get like the same held true for the post offices, right? Different postal services were staring into declining regular way postal volumes. And so what did they do? They went on diversification strategies. I did a lot of work for TNT 15 years ago on the fact that they rolled up the warehouse logistics space, and they were trying to go down the path of adding growth to their profile. In that instance, it wasn't as successful as they would have liked, but DHL, buying XL, right? These are trajectory shifting, Pitney Bowes buying logistics. These are trajectory shifting strategies that management teams are embracing. So I think there is, absolutely, this issue about, getting disintermediated is a real one, and you see it in many strategies across the global supply chain.
Since we've started getting into, commentary on specific deals, Chris, I should just ask you, What's the most interesting deal that you guys have put together recently? And then what's the most interesting deal you've seen out in the market that you guys weren't necessarily a part of?
Yeah, well, thanks for asking that. You know, this has been really exciting for me. I worked 30 years at major banks, Bear Stearns, B of A, Macquarie, Wells Fargo, and went out on my own in early 2021. And we've had a real spate of M&A successes rolling into 2022. So couldn't be more excited. We did almost $1 billion worth of transaction volume last year. The one that I'm probably the most excited about is representing Ryder on buying Whiplash, which is their e-commerce platform acquisition. That was a deal just under $500 million in enterprise value. And what that did is that enabled Ryder to accelerate their e-commerce footprint, which was moving along, but wasn't moving along at the pace they wanted. And, you know, Jeff Walpov and Greg Morello are, you know, a really strong management team, which gave Steve Sensing, the head of SCS, the opportunity to take his own e-commerce footprint and tuck it in under the Whiplash team. So you've got a newly invigorated management team with a newly expanded range of services that is going to bring a lot of change for Ryder. And, you know, one of the things that we, you know, we want to just note is that that Whiplash acquisition that the old Port Logistics Group did, right, because this was Port Logistics Group before it was Whiplash, brought a technology base that was transformative for what became the combined Whiplash business. It brought in the whole e-sellers market and an acceleration. We talked about curves, an acceleration of the growth curve for Port Logistics Group that became renamed Whiplash. So I think that one's really exciting. It enables Ryder to service customers all over the country in 48 hours time, and it'll be transformational for them.
And then a deal that Wofford Advisors wasn't part of?
Well, you know, we competed hard on Merck's acquisition of Visible Supply Chain. I think that that's a really strong management team. You know, hats off to Jared and Casey. They're terrific operators, and they're bringing a special formula to Merck. I think that that penetration into the parcel market and also the B2B penetration just brings a whole expansion of the tools to Merck. That, you know, they did a great job buying Performance Team. You know, Craig Kaplan's a great operator, but that was only a limited piece of the B2C landscape. And now with Visible, I think they've got a much more robust service set.
It's so interesting to see these deals that, to me, you know, are pretty ambitious and creative. I think I first used those two words to describe an M&A deal. I think it was Uber Freight's acquisition of Transplace. I was like, wow, this is, you know, not what I expected. Very interesting. Lots of potential synergies, but ultimately, just like, you know, it's very different than Uber taking an equity stake in some other ride-hailing app or Uber Freight buying and not, you know, buying a different digital freight brokerage, right? And I kept returning to that theme of, you know, whether it's bankers, whether it's corporate development people on the buy side, you know, seemingly having like a little bit more vision about the way that these services can be combined and the way that you know, they may come together to, you know, so that, you know, 1 + 1 = 3 for the customer, and they can you know, do a lot more for them and grow with their customers a lot more. And my question for you, Chris, is this willingness to entertain, you know, multimodal mergers or cross-modal mergers, however you want to define it, is that being driven just by capital that needs to be deployed and people need to buy companies and so they're forced to be creative? Or do you think that we're really living through a time when logistics companies are willing to kind of reimagine themselves and, you know, maybe they don't know what they're going to look like 10 years from now? And,
you know, I use the I'm a big believer in learning by analogy, right? We've seen a lot of industries move to a barbell type structure. And I think that that's fundamentally what's going on here, right? There was a time when specialization was really rewarded by the equity markets. So, you know, migrating off of 4 years core capability set 10 or 15 years ago would have been a mistake, or Hub's core capability set. And what we've seen with time is that those business models, and I'm not picking on those two companies in particular, but the specialization has become to a broadening. Now, why is that? Because it's because of what we talked about earlier, which is capitalizing on the customer relationship, right? If you think about the hardest thing to obtain, it's the opportunity to sell to that customer with a viable solution set. And unquestionably, we'll see increased bundling. I worked for UPS many, many years ago when they bought Overnight, and they've since exited Overnight. But at the time, that was a critical part of the bundle, right? They wanted to be able to sweep the docks for their customers and not have any product set be uncovered by their range of services. That was back when they did the 100-weight program, which had not been very successful for them. But this migration away from specialization towards, and I'm not saying that in every case, right? There's some really cool businesses like Rocket Cargo that we could talk about that maintain their specialization. But what we're seeing is to own that customer relationship, you need to do more end-to-end and deeper. And so you talked about Transplace and Uber Freight buying Transplace. Well, that brought a whole bunch of things to Uber Freight. The penetration into the enterprise value solution, along with real, a fundamental deepening and broadening of their truckload brokerage network and the cross-selling of the TMS platform. So I think this issue of end-to-end networks broadening and deepening is going on, and that's going to lead to the increased, call it the supermarket and the specialty store. And I think the place you don't want to be is stuck in the middle, which is much like what happened in the investment banking world, which I grew up in.
So how do you interpret, for example, the divestment of XPO and GXO, right? In that context, right? You have Brad Jacobs, like the quintessential bundler, M&A guy, builds up these huge conglomerates. Then he's reading the paper and sees Old Dominion's valuation and is like, hey, wait a minute, is my business actually being, is it getting the full value of the market? I bring that up because it's the only real counterexample I can think of to this sort of larger bundling trend. And I just wonder what you make of that.
Yeah, sure. Well, first of all, hats off to the Cogdens on one of the great success stories in the transportation space. I've known, Earl and David for forever. And I mean, just what an amazing story. But, their operations are also, in most cases, at least two stair steps ahead of the pack.
Yeah, they're special.
They're a special company. But to your point, look, I respect Brad immensely, and he is a very financially driven and along with being visionary. I mean, what he put together in terms of the capability set is absolutely consistent with what I was just saying. He just started it, 8 or 10 years ago. But I think if the sum of the parts had been creating an appropriate valuation, I don't think that XPO would have spun off GXO. Now, it's important to remember that the Norbert acquisition was a really critical doubling or tripling down on trucking. Hidden within Norbert, I shouldn't say hidden, but within Norbert was also a very good warehouse logistics business. They'd bought the Jacobson companies. In fact, I advised on Norbert buying Jacobson, which put them into the U.S. market in chemicals and CPG. There was a very good warehouse logistics business in there. So, by acquiring Norbert, the pro forma pie chart of what XPO looked like was very heavily on the trucking side. And I think the LTL, the old Conway, has had some operating struggles, and the Norbert footprint was not the deepest margin profile business. So, putting warehouses, I mean, there was never, it's a fascinating question, actually, because there was never a pure play B2B or B2C warehousing company. And the question always was, well, does that trade at 8 to 10 or does it trade better? And what I think GXO under Malcolm's leadership has done is it's expanded into e-commerce and so added a growth vehicle that doesn't get lost in the entirety of XPO. Now,
it makes the story a little bit easier to tell.
Makes the story easier to tell, right? We're pure play B2B, B2C warehouse logistics and some ancillary services. And then you've got the mother, you know, what used to be the mothership. I just think there's some operational issues that need to get worked out, at least from the data that I've seen. But look, XPO as it stands today is still a really interesting array of companies. So I take your point, which is that it cuts against my thesis, but the thesis has to be predicated on all the cross-selling working and creating synergies across all those business units.
Definitely. Chris, last question. What's your number one piece of advice for owners of 3PLs who may be considering selling them?
Well, this is self-serving, but my number one piece of advice is don't try to do it on your own, because there's a whole lot of people who don't cost all that much money who are going to walk you through it and help you get the outcome you want. That sometimes is value maximization. Sometimes it's other things. Like, I want the brand name of the company I created to stay on the door, the side of the truck. Or, you know, I've got children or siblings who are in the business, and the way they get treated in terms of an ongoing role or their economics really matters to me, right? So it's not as simple as just dollars and cents. But again, that's a self-serving answer. Look, I think that the most important thing right now is you get really good valuation advice so that you're thinking through those issues about, you know, did I have a COVID bump? What does the future look like? And if everything is just a, you know, hey, it's all rosy sailing in your forecast, it's very likely that's going to get pressure tested extensively by buyers. So you got to be prepared to defend your case. And again, generally speaking, that's going to be falling back on folks like my team in order to help you have all the answers and be prepared for those tough questions.
Great. Well, Chris, thank you so much for joining us, and stay tuned for more action from our 3PL Summit.
Great to be here.